Actually, does this sound like one of our people? Okay, never mind, I'll do a check.
So, what do you do now? Kicks off. But no, it's chanting in the morning. So not in the evening, are you doing some chanting? Or questions and answers? Okay. Where's the questions? Or shall we have the answers without questions? Just make peace. Be kind. Let go. Okay, that's the answer to all your questions. Is that very good? No. Okay, here comes the basket with all my questions on it. Oh, why does the basket get more full every day? You're supposed to be getting wiser. You have more questions along these stages. Okay, I'll get them from the bottom first. I'll turn them upside down. Start from the bottom. Here we go. The bottom question. Okay, here we go. Your emptiness, that's a very good start. I have been a good boy. That's what they all say. I've been meditating every day this year. I have noticed that every meditation is very different. Sometimes it's very calm. Sometimes very turbulent. When I reflect at the end, very often, I can't discern the cause for the calm or the storm. Could you please enlighten us? Yes, of course, that's my job. How should one ensure more calm? For info, I am already sticking to the 5 precepts every day. Even not killing mosquitoes, except cockroaches. And cockroaches, something we've got here, and why? There's another word in between it. Forcing something. I think forced by my wife. Right. That's got life in here, W-I-F-E. That's why. Anyway. Also, is it possible to hypnotize oneself? Or can auto-suggestion oneself to the giants with method? Good boy. So first of all, when you meditate, you can't always expect to get good meditations every time. Once there was a man who went to work on a Monday. At the end of the day, he didn't get any money. He went to work again on Tuesday and worked very, very hard. And again he never got paid. He tried one more day on Wednesday going to work, and still never got paid. So he told his wife, right, that's it. What's the point of working if you don't get paid? His wife forced him to go to work on Thursday, and still he never got paid. He went to work on Friday because he had nothing else to do. And on Friday, his boss gave him a big check. So when he went home on Friday, he said, from now on, I'm only going to work on Fridays. Because you get paid on Friday or once a fortnight or once a month for all the work you've done on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday. And so when you have your good meditations, that's payday. You get the check for all the work which you've done on those so-called difficult meditations. But you can't expect every day to be payday. It'd be nice, wouldn't it? So you can't expect every meditation to be a payday for you. And you keep on doing it until you really, really get into some nice meditation. You have to do some work sometimes. But then, eventually, you get the check. And for those of you who have been meditating so much since you came here, and you haven't got any peaceful meditation yet, please take my word for it, the check is in the mail. It's coming! That's sometimes what happens. There are different meditations. But after a while, you get the paycheck more and more frequently when you find out what's going on. One of the reasons is because you get a nice meditation and you expect the next one to be good also. That expectation is a terrible thing. So instead of expecting the results, your job is just to keep on building up the causes. Raw karma, make the causes, the results come. But just keep meditating, making peace, being kind, being gentle. And then when you have enough peace in the bank, enough kindness in your account, enough gentleness stored up in your piggy bank, then you get the results. Beautiful peace. And stillness and kindness and lots and lots of insight. This is what you build up. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if you had a mantra, what would it be? My mantra would be No, it depends on what type of state of mind is. So you have lots of mantras. When in the forest tradition, you always used to have the mantra of Buddho. I did mention it to someone earlier. As you breathe in, you chant to yourself Bud. As you breathe out, so Buddho along with the breath. So I tried teaching that when I went to Australia. But you know the people never liked it, because if you're in Thailand, the people are Buddhists, and the word Buddho has a really very powerful meaning. So when you chant Buddho along with your breath, that really means something. But for Australians, it means nothing. So I had to invent another mantra, especially for Australians. And that became very, very popular. Instead of saying Buddho, Buddho along with your in and out breath, as you breathe in, you say shut. And as you breathe out, up. That's very good, you should try that. Because after a while you do shut up. Or one of the other favourite mantras, this actually came from the Thai forest tradition, and this actually translated very, very well into English. And this is a mantra you use when you're doing walking meditation. Hopefully you've tried walking meditation. In many places, you know, like if you're in a temple, it's too small to do walking meditation. Here you've got the whole grounds of the hotel, so you've got lots of places you can do walking meditation. So how do you do walking meditation with a mantra? You know, as your left foot moves, you say one word, your right foot moves another word. But the word you use, which is very powerful, as you move your left foot, the left step, you say to yourself, I will die. And as you do your right foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I know there's some Thai people here, that's as your left foot moves, die. And as your right foot moves, nah, die, nah, die, nah. I will die, that's for sure. Now you try that. At first when you try that, you think it's very funny, it's a joke. You keep saying that and you realise, hang on, that's not really a joke. That's one thing which you can actually say is hard and fast truth. Something you don't need to die. Doubt. I will die, that's for sure. So after thinking it's a joke, the next thing is, it's serious stuff. And then you get afraid. You keep on walking, I will die, that's for sure, I will die, that's for sure. And once you keep on going, the fear passes pretty quickly. And then you let go. I will die, that's for sure, I will die, that's for sure. You put all these silly attachments and thoughts and worries and concerns in perspective. You don't need them anymore. I will die, that's for sure. You get to that stage of feeling so free. So if you do that, chant, joke, it's a fun first of all, and then you realise it's truth. Then you get afraid, keep going, and then you let go. Those are the stages of doing, I will die, that's for sure, I will die, that's for sure. That's what I think it is. Some of you will get afraid, but keep on walking. Because on the other side of that fear, this beautiful peace, you're letting go of all the passion, you're feeling free. So that's a really nice mantra to do. I will die, that's for sure. Okay, so that's some mantras which you can use. I hope that's what it meant. Next question. Thank you. I am a young Buddhist, although I'm not too young anymore. Yeah, that's what we all say. We're all very young. I am only a little bit over 40. About 21 years old. But anyway, may I know what is samsara? Samsara is the son of Mr. and Mrs. Sara. And the son, they call it Sam. What it really means is perpetual wandering, always moving. So the root meaning of that is, you know this because for many of you that's your life, always going on to the next thing, always moving, never staying still. That's samsara. And that's its root meaning, but it's expressed itself in this reincarnation, this wheel of life, being born from one place to another place to another place, going round and round and round, round and round and round, round and round and round, going round and round, now being born as a boy, now being born as a girl, now being born as hot, now being born as ugly, now being born as rich, now being born as poor, round and round and round and round we go, in all the different permutations of life, perpetual wandering from place to place, never finding any peace. That's this powerful word. If you really understand that, you understand why we meditate. To stop. I've used this simile for the present moment. But sometimes, like we all know life is a journey, and sometimes we're always on the move. We're always having to do something else to get somewhere else, or to get something which is really important. We're already, we haven't left yet, but even on lunchtime we had all the lists on the board about who's going where and what time the bus is leaving. We're always on the move even though we've never left yet. And that's our life. And this meditation is brilliant. With all your business and all the duties which you have, we ask you to stop and just be here. Stop your journey for a little while. And it's like meditation, it's like you find this stone, lumpy, cold bench by the side of your path, of your life. It's not a nice thing to sit down on, but it's all you've got. So you stop and sit down on it. That's why I come into the present moment. At first, present moment awareness is not very comfortable. But you just sit down on that bench, have a rest, stop all this going into the future and the past and thinking and planning and doing things. Stop for a little while. But what happens, the longer you sit on that bench, the smoother it becomes, the warmer it becomes, and the softer it becomes. Yeah, it's a hard, lumpy, stone, cold bench at first. But soon it turns into the softest of sofas. Really warm and comfortable. The longer you stay in the present moment, the more comfortable it is. This is actually what happens. You really need a rest. A rest from all this coming and going, which is the meaning of samsara. So that's why stopping samsara and wandering is being still and resting for a little while. And you all deserve that rest. A lot of people don't know how to rest. They go on in their life and never stop and say, well, what? You ask your parents and grandparents, always doing something, never just sitting down, enjoying the moment. Next question. The phrase suffering is inherent in the fabric of samsara. What is the actual meaning? The actual meaning is that suffering is inherent in the fabric of samsara. Exactly what it said, because I think you got that from my book. So that means, you know, the fabric of samsara means just in all this wandering. The very fact that you always have to wander backwards and forwards without any rest. That is very, very suffering. That's a lot of tiring. You can't even stop thinking, even when you want to have a bit of peace. But the outside is still quiet, inside your head, so much noise going on. And you've forgotten where the delete button is, so you can't shut it off. But these monsters inside your head. having this conversation, they never shut up. And after a while you get so fed up with that, that's so much suffering. And when you stop all that wandering and all that doing, samsara stops, the wandering stops, you're still, then you know what happiness truly is. That is one of the reasons, this is serious, why I love teaching meditation. Now and again somebody gets it, they're still, they realize, wow, this is really peaceful, this is really happiness. This is something very, very profound and deep. You're experiencing it. It's not something you teach. It's something you show people how to experience. And when you have those wonderful, peaceful, still moments, that really changes your life. Then you know what Buddhism really is. Buddhism is the art of stillness and the joy and the freedom. You want to be free? You want to have peace of mind? This is where you get it. Amazing. It's a certain, it really is priceless to notice how to be at peace. You know, everything may be going wrong in your life. You may be having cancer, you may have blown your relationship, you may be so poor, you've got debts, you're going to go to prison. Whatever, when anything goes wrong, you can be still so peaceful and so happy. You never have any fear anymore. You know peace, you know stillness. It's always there for you. At any moment, you can just stop and be peaceful and be joyful and be free. So that's what, when you understand how to do that, you understand what the Buddha meant by suffering. You're all in the prison. And the gate of the prison is free, it's open, so you just need to walk out, but you don't want to walk out. You don't used to walking out, you're afraid of walking out. You're afraid of stopping thinking, you're doing nothing. The gate is always open. Why don't you just walk through? Why didn't I do that before? Why don't I just let go and be free? And in that prison, there is a sadistic prison guard. And that sadistic prison guard who never lets you rest is called Mr. Will. Will. That's what stops you being still. Always gives you more things to do. Well, after a while I say, shut up, Will. I'm not going to do anything. I've had enough of you. I'm going to be peaceful. I'm going to let go. Let things be. And then I'm free from prison. I'm just happy being here. Deep stuff on your last day here. We need to respond by Nibbida. How to disengage from the world and loved ones. Oh, you disengage from trying to disengage. In other words, you have your loved ones and you respect them and you're kind to them when they're in front of you. But when they're gone, when you're by yourself, then you are the most important person in the world. This is the Emperor's Three Questions, a brilliant teaching. It was told by Tolstoy. Where he got it from, I don't know, but it's absolutely brilliant. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person? And what's the most important thing to do? The only three questions you ever need to know the answer to. And when is the most important time? Now. When is the most important time to tell your husband, your wife, your kids that you really love them? So go do that. Okay, say it back. That's right, because if you don't do that now, the opportunity never comes. You're always going to do it, and if you don't do it, it goes tomorrow, the next week, the next year, and just time passes, and you're dead before you can tell the people you really love how much you love them. But if you want to ask the kids, let's do it now. It's easier to do it now than do it tomorrow. But now is the most important time. Who is the most important person? It's a great question, isn't it? Because many of you have read it in my book. But when I ask this to people who've never heard this story before, they always say, myself. That's like Western psychology, and you know how screwed up people are in the West. That's not the most important person. The most important person in this story is the one right in front of you. Whoever that happens to be. And you know, I've been practicing that for many, many years. So when you come to those interviews and you sit in front of me, if I'm relating to you and I'm connecting with you, it's because when I see you right in front of me, you are the only important person in the world for me. And I give you 100% full respect and attention. But when you leave, you're totally out of my mind. I don't remember you. Because a new person is in there, and that new person is now the most important person in the world. Now that's how you can love people. Because the last thing is, what's the most important thing to do? Is to care. Care is halfway between being careful and caring. And that's what I keep on saying for doctors and nurses and other therapists. Your most important job to do is not to cure your patients, but to care for them. That's your job as doctors. Curing is secondary, caring is primary. As long as they feel cared and loved for and respected, if they die, it doesn't matter. As long as you've been cared for, you've succeeded as a doctor or as a nurse. A lot of times you make care the prime goal of your career in a hospital. You'll find you cure many more people than others. But when they die, they know they've been cared for. So those are the three questions there. So that's actually how I love my relations, and I have loved each one of you. When you're in front of me, I love you, I care for you, you're really important for me. When you're gone, other people take that. It's a wonderful way of living a life. But if, you know, I have a family and I love them, and when you're right in front of me, I'm thinking of family, I'm not thinking of you, so I can't connect with you. That's the problem with attachments. It means that our love is stuck in one place and can't move to the people in front of us. That's the way we get rid of or disengage from loved ones when they're not with you. When they're with you, they're really important. When they're gone, the next person's important. That's metta, loving kindness, compassion in the moment. Really wonderful way of living. So that's actually how you live. But there are very deep, if I keep going on like this, we'll be here all night. Question: how do you help someone who is so fussy with maids? How can we guide her to appreciate the maid and enjoy her time and moments? I do that is give your maid a holiday, so your wife or husband has to do all the maid's work for 2 weeks. And when the maid comes back, oh, you're such a wonderful maid, thank you so much for coming. It's so good. No, I mean, remember the maids, they are, you know, so important in their life, so you have to care for them. Remember what the loving kindness chant we do. May all beings be happy and well. And that includes maids. So if you look after your maids, the maid will look after you. Any other employee you have, you look after them, the maid will look after you. So please, no, don't be so fussy, be kind, and be gentle. So that way you can appreciate her and enjoy the time and the moments with the maids. Very good. Last question. Why are the candles and gossips next to you alight? Because we've got to save the planet. We've got to reduce global warming. And that increases the heat. Why do you want to light candles and gossips? They're very nice as they are, it just destroys them. So we let them just be, instead of lighting them. So that's just traditions and ceremonies. You don't have to do that, so we just leave it there. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you for your teachings. I read your book on the art of disappearing. It mentioned about samsara nirodha, how to disengage and become detached. That's one of those other questions which is synchronous. I just answered that question afterwards. So that's the same question already been answered. The next one, in the great list of questions, the endless pit of questions. The other problem is human population grows, one animal extinct, the result of more sentient beings being born in the human realm. But why does human beings become the ones who destroy the earth more than any other beings? Isn't human life the precious human life to accumulate merit according to Buddhist teachings? Thank you. Yeah, that's true. There's so many animals are becoming extinct, and there's more human beings in this planet. which obviously means that animals are now being reborn as human beings, which explains some of the behaviour of your children. You often say they're little monkeys, and they may very well have been. So yeah, that's what happens. And this is a precious human life, but like anything else, when you have something very precious, very often you can just disregard it. You don't realise how precious it is. So many people, they just waste their lives. And that's what happens whenever I do funeral services. Sometimes, any time I get sad, it doesn't matter when a person dies, when they're young or old, it's just whether they wasted their life or not. If they lived a very good life, even only in a few years, they've brought lots of love and happiness to people, then their life has never been wasted. And I feel very happy when they die. If someone has lived 80, 90, 100 years of age, they've been very wealthy, but they haven't really shared their wealth with others, they haven't shown love to their family. And I've been to funerals like that, only one or two people turn up. Then what a waste of a life. What a shame. That makes me sad. So if you've done a good job, then it's never shame. So there is an advantage, there is an opportunity here. That's why human life is precious to make merit. But some people don't take that opportunity. They're just selfish. Can you please repeat the instruction on how to go to sleep in a deep sleep and better relaxation? Yeah, I've told that the first night. Let's get a hammer and get your wife to bang you on the head. Then you go to a nice deep sleep. And you wake up in a hospital. And your husband goes to jail. No, that's not the way to go. There's nice deep sleep. Well, I mentioned that there's many ways. One way is to not try to go to sleep. In other words, remember the benefits of lying down in a nice, soft, comfortable bed. So nice. The dentist, that's why I'm not afraid of going to the dentist. Because in those dentist chairs these days, they're the most comfortable chair I've ever been in. Even sometimes I have flown business class, and even the business class on Singapore Airlines is nothing like the dentist chairs. They're contoured to your body, and they press it down, and it's so nice. So when I'm in that dentist chair, honestly, it's the most comfortable chair I've ever been in. I don't get any aches in the back or aches in the leg. If you ever want to get some good meditation, buy a dentist chair. Now, don't buy the drill or other stuff. Just buy a dentist, and they have wonderful meditation. And even those of you who have trouble, you know, sometimes with saliva when you're meditating, people sometimes have that saliva start with it. Get one of those dentist things, cut it out. And then we can meditate with saliva. So that's, I'll go to sleep, yeah, so that's one way, just enjoy just being in your nice, comfortable bed. If you don't want to go to sleep, you're going to sleep very quickly. And the other way, which you know, I haven't taught here yet, that's that you've got it on the table, I've taught it many times, that's doing the sweeping method. You know, you relax the body one by one. Starting from the toes, relaxing your toes, relaxing your feet, relaxing your calves, relaxing your knees. It's not long enough to explain that one right here, but you can get it on the instructions which I've given in many places. I'm sure it's on the BF website somewhere, you can get the guided meditation on sweeping. And doing that, that really relaxes you. And usually, before you get to your knees, you're fast asleep. And one of the reasons why you can't go to sleep is the tightness and tension stored in your body. Maybe your body aches. Maybe you might not notice that, but it's tight, and that's stopping going to sleep. So relaxing the body is a wonderful way of going to sleep. But those are some ways of going to sleep. And of course, the other last one I mentioned a couple of nights ago, which is very, very, very effective, is like turning on one of Ajahn Brahm's talks. We may not be lucky some to have you by our side before we die. Just in case we drop dead and haven't had enough meditation practice to know what to do, can you please be so kind to give some pointers? Thank you. We've meditated always. Okay, if you're dying, now don't try and send me an email or phone call. Ajahn Brahm, I'm going to come quickly, I'm carding it. Because I will not come. If you really want me by your bedside, get a photo. That's all you're going to get. That's good. What is very nice to do is lots of talks which I've given. One of the reasons why all these are common questions, I've given actually a talk a couple of years ago, maybe just 1 year ago, in Perth on how to die. So detailed instructions on what to do. You know, you have instructions on how to drive a car, You know, before you get married, you get counselling on how to have a marriage. When you're pregnant, you go through those instructions on how to have a baby. You get instructions on everything except the most certain thing you're going to do in life is dying. So we should have dying classes. How to die. So it makes a lot of sense. You know where those classes are held? Right here, right now. It's called meditation, it's called Dharma. This is how to die 101. And if you don't get it right, if you fail, you don't die well. You have to come back again and repeat the class. You get bored again. So that's what happened last time. To me as well, I stopped off the lessons at the end. Well, I don't get bored again. You find out exactly what to do. And basically, it's like, oh, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Stop worrying about anything. Don't be afraid. Especially stay in the present moment. Because all fear is about what's going to happen next. But don't fear at all. Just be. If you train to do that while you're alive, it's so easy to do in your life. Have a wonderful time. Whenever you go to the future, you start expecting things or be afraid of things. It's really a lot of problems. Or when you leave it in the past and start thinking of all the things you've done, already many people think of all the bad things they've done. That's why I keep saying to you, remember all the good things you have done. When you train yourself to do that while you're still alive, you have a much happier life. And when you die, instead of thinking about the bad things you've done in life, which you save you to a lower level, you've already let that go because you've come to these classes many times. Instead, you just carry with you the beautiful stuff you've done in the past. All the 998 good drinks in the wall of your life. Remember all the kindness, the charity, the fun you've had, the love you've given and received. That's what you remember when you die. You go to a very high heaven realm. If you don't want to be reborn at all, you let go of all the past and all the future. Stay in the present moment. Be still. And you're so still that you disappear. And when the bus comes to take you to the next life, it can't find you. Look too still, you vanish. And the bus leaves. You don't go anywhere. You disappear. For you, that's the end of the samsara. Very easy to do. Now you learn it here. Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if my son is a Christian and I'm a Buddhist, will I meet him in heaven? If we all meet in the same realm, why every religion depicts heaven differently? Yeah, that's really, really crazy. Is there a heaven realm just for the Christians? And is there a heaven realm just for the Buddhists? If there is, I'm going to choose a Buddhist heaven realm. But in the Christian heaven realm, I remember hearing about this when I was at school. You always have to wear white clothes. I don't like white clothes. You know, white clothes are so hard to keep clean. Brown is my favourite colour. I don't like white. And you have to wear this donut on top of your head. Which I don't think is very cool at all. And you don't get any nice music. It's harsh all the time. Okay, harp music may be okay sometimes, but I like rock. So in Christian heaven you don't get any rock music, but how many of these rock stars are Buddhist? There's lots of these rock stars are Buddhist, so you get really good music in Buddhist heaven. Really boring stuff in Christian heaven. And as for food, I was told this, that in Christian heaven you just get ambrosia. I don't even know what it is. But I tell you, I prefer fish and chips. So if there is different heavens for different people, you know, just Buddhist heaven is a bit better. But the real truth of the matter is, it does not matter whether you are Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, or whatever. No one has a franchise to the keys of heaven. We always think we own things, but you don't. Good people, no matter what religion, or even if they're atheists, go to heaven. This is an old story, but it's a very good one. This was actually came from a Christian philosopher many, many years ago. And it's a brilliant story. He said that one day I can't stop now. Because, you know, there's so many questions here, I'm not going to finish these, but never mind. So, there's this Christian priest, he was giving his sermon on a Sunday,
It was all about heaven and hell, and believing in Jesus is the only way to go to heaven. Anyway, at the end of his sermon, this new attendee of church stood up to ask a question. Now normally you don't ask questions when you go to church. This guy was very rich, and he was also a professor of philosophy. And so, would anyone that rich ask you a question, even in church, because everyone needs donations? He said, I'll make an exception, what's your question? And it was a very deep question. The priest said, there have been many very wonderful people alive in this world who weren't Christians. Such as, the Buddha. Everybody knows he's very kind and compassionate. Such as, the Socrates. Very moral person, very, very wise. He was a philosopher, he wasn't a Christian. You got people like the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, who wrote his wonderful reflections. You got people like more modern people, like Voltaire, or maybe Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma Gandhi wasn't a Christian. So what happens to those people? Do they have to go to hell, even though they were so good and so wonderful and they helped so many people in this world? But the priest said, it's a bit late now, so I'll answer the question next week. If you don't know, procrastinate. That's a wonderful technique. So he's promised that. So usually, on Sunday, you work hard as a Christian priest. So on Monday, you always have a day off. He had a day off, he rested. On Tuesday, he went to his library to try and get a good answer. Couldn't find a good answer in any of the books. So he made an appointment to see a senior priest on Wednesday. He went to see the senior priest, asked the question, try and find an answer. The senior priest said, that was too much for me. Go and see the bishop. So he saw the bishop on Thursday. And the bishop said, this is too difficult for me. You have to see the archbishop. So on Friday he saw the archbishop. The archbishop said, what you really should go and ask is a theologian in the university. So on Saturday he asked the theologian at the university. The theologian gave him an answer, but he couldn't understand a word of it. You know what it's like with theologians and professors at university. And so he was left there Saturday evening. He hadn't got an answer. The following morning he would have to face up to the professor and give an answer. And so he had a very sleepless night worrying how he could answer this question. Because he didn't sleep well that night, he got up early in the morning, he thought, still hadn't got an answer. The only thing he could do is to go into the church and pray. So he went to the church really early and started praying. And just like many of you when you meditate, when people pray, they also fall asleep. So he fell fast asleep and he had one of these dreams, these lucid dreams. He dreamt he was on a railway station. And on that platform he saw a train about to leave. And he realized, through dreams, you get answers to your questions. So he went up to a station master and said, that train, it would be going to a place called heaven, would it? And the station master said, yes. And seeing as you're a religious fellow, you can go up there for your charge. So he got on the train, like those dreams, that time is really changed. In no time at all, the train pulled into this platform. And on the side of the platform was written very clear letters, H-E-A-V-E-N, was heaven. And he got out of the train. It was a very pleasant place. And soon he went up to see this person. And the person says, welcome. He said, oh great, but do you mind if I ask a couple of questions? And the person said, yes, of course. People are very kind up in heaven. What are your questions? He said, first of all, how long have you been in here? Well, I've been up here hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Thousands of years, actually. Great, said the priest. My second question is, do you know anybody up here by the names of the Buddha? Lord Buddha? Never heard of that. What about Socrates, a Greek guy? There's a lot of Greeks up here, but no one named Socrates. What about Marcus Aurelius? What about Voltaire? What about Gandhi? A little black fellow. Just come up, new arrival. Never heard of him. And he thought, wow, I've got my answer. These people are up in heaven. So feeling very self-satisfied, he got back to the station to get a train back to work. But he saw on another platform, there was another train about to leave. And again, he knew instinctively where that train was heading. So he asked the station master, that train over there, would it be going to hell? He said, yes, it is. So he bought a return ticket. He better want to get into the car as well. And he got on the train in no time at all. This train pulled into another station. And on the side of the platform you could see big letters, H-E-L-L, as you have on railway stations. But they were actually, it was really weird. They had these red, yellow and green balloons on the side saying it was hell. And when he came out of the train, this guy came up to meet him. Welcome, sir. Welcome to this place. Can I get you a cup of tea? Or would you like something to eat? We've got very nice jewelry down here. Would you like some? And he said, well, look, very nice of you, but I come here to ask you a couple of questions. I'll take a rest, first of all. Then you can ask a question. No, I'm in a hurry. Okay, sir, what are your questions? He was very, very nice. So look, firstly, what's this place called? It says it's hell. Yes, it's hell. Welcome here. Are you sure you don't want something to eat or drink? So look. Is there anybody? How have you been here? He said, I've been here thousands of years. He said, great. Do you know anyone here called the Buddha?
Oh, the Buddha. So wise.
Oh, so compassionate. Anyone here by the name of Socrates? Wow. He is so wise. He sees so deeply into things. Marcus Aurelius? Oh, so virtuous. Oh, Confucius? Oh, he is just so smart and so moral. What about Voltaire? Yeah, he's very funny. Gandhi? Oh, he's one of the best new additions we've had. Such a simple man. Oh, people loved him down here. And the priest said, look, this is really weird. I expected all these people down here, but in my book it says there's so much suffering and pain down here. And you've got balloons on the station, and you're so kind to me, even more kind than in heaven. This is supposed to be a place of torment. And the fellow said, oh yeah, it used to be like that, before the Buddha came down here. Now that is not true, but that is a simile, an old simile by a Christian philosopher, who made the point that people make the place. The place doesn't make the people. If good people go to a place, they make it a wonderful heaven. And if self-centered, conceited, arrogant people who say theirs is the only religion and everyone else must go to hell, wherever they go will be a pretty unpleasant place. Would you like to be with such people? Or would you like to be with people who tell jokes, who are kind, who are warm? But really, that's the answer to that question. You make heaven, not that heaven makes you. If you're a good person, you create goodness all around you, in whatever life you go to. If you're selfish and mean, you create hell wherever you go. No matter what you believe, is what you do. Anyway, next question. Oh, here we go. The Ekambar question. Buddha was beside me. I asked Buddha, can you bless me? Then he said, come child, before he chants. I clapped my hand and kneeled down. I heard the chanting, then I woke up. What does it mean? Arise. It means you were tired. That's why you're so sick. Has Ekambar ever stopped teaching someone who is stubborn and does not believe you and let him go? I keep teaching them, but they're the ones who leave after the end. I've got more endurance than they have. And that's why they're the ones who leave after a while. People aren't stubborn, they're just a bit stupid, that's all. That's good. I have all along been a light sleeper. I often wake up in the night by the slightest sound. There are times I couldn't get back to sleep once I awoke. Is it advisable to meditate in a lying position under such situations? If so, kindly advise how. Thank you. Yeah, look, if you're under very light sleeper as well, because I'd say I lived most of my life in my cave, which is really, really quiet. You know, and I live in monasteries, which are very peaceful places. That's why I say that, you know, wherever you take me to teach or whatever, or any sort of new place in Buddhist fellowship, please just have a quiet room. And you can work me to the bone as long as I can get a quiet place to sleep at night. And that's, you know, sometimes you get noisy places and I can't sleep and I get really tired. Because I'm a light sleeper too, just because I've been conditioned that way. So because of that, I understand what you're talking about there, but you can find quiet places to sleep. And if you do meditate, try and meditate in a position you don't normally go to sleep in. So in other words, I usually go to sleep on my side. Mostly the right side, but sometimes the left side. I never go to sleep on my back. I don't know why, but I just don't do that. So if I were to meditate, I lie on my back. And so my brain says, look, he's lying in this position, it can't be that he wants me to go to sleep. So the brain stays awake. So if I try to meditate on my right side, then I do go to sleep, because my body is conditioned for that. So if you do meditation like that, please meditate lying on your side or your back, wherever, in a position you don't normally go to sleep in. And also, please don't do it on your bed. Because I know that sometimes people like to sit meditation on their bed, but every bed has got what we call magnetic pillows. They destroy your head, you can't stop it. So if you sit in meditation, you can take some cushions on the floor. But doing it outside of your bed, even if you do, like you lay on your back on my bed, you just turn over and you go to sleep. So try doing it on the floor, on a mattress or something. That's the best. Yeah, question. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, to be here with us at this meditation retreat, saying your interesting stories and jokes. After the fabulous retreat, how do we bring Buddhist teaching and meditation to the corporate living world? And then our life, thank you. What do you mean after this retreat? It hasn't ended yet. So remember, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? There may be an airline strike at Phuket Airport, and you're not going anywhere. The future is so uncertain. So remember, these are just tentative plans. So all plans remember should be properly able to be changed at a moment's notice. So yeah, how do you bring to the corporate world? Is actually that's my job, and that's also your job, to tell your corporate world that these teachings work. I told somebody what I told you before at the BF in Singapore. In Dell Computing, one of the top companies in our world, they have a time-out room in their headquarters. It's a room where anybody can go at any time of the day on the company's time to relax, to meditate. And it screens, so even if you take your BlackBerry down there, you can't get a signal. Because it's a place which is there for total rest. The next time we go to a retreat, especially the 8-precept retreat, we should confiscate all mobile phones and BlackBerries to give you guys a break. So you can be at peace for a while. You'll find out in 3 or 4 days the world doesn't end because you don't answer your emails. It's not a chaotic. You're not like Obama who has to answer his emails. You're not that important. So let it go. So in this Dell Computing, you can't. The screen. So you can't actually get any message at all. So when you go down there, it is for rest. And they do that because they know 10 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour of relaxation means afterwards you are far more efficient the way you use your brain. You get more work done in a shorter time of higher quality. So it's such a simple idea. When you keep pushing your brain when it's tired, number one, your output goes down. You don't do so much. And number two, you make many, many mistakes. Because you're not clear. In big corporations, they cannot afford to make those mistakes. That's why Dell Computing is a very, very successful company. And that's one of the strategies which they use. They can tell people, look, we need a time out room in our company, in our corporate headquarters, a place where anyone can go at any time. Screened. No talking down there. No SMSs. No writing any memos. Just for rest and relaxation. So you can de-stress, and afterwards you go back to your workstation, you find you can perform. That would be wonderful. That would increase the economic performance of Singapore, Malaysia, Austria, wherever you come from. Dear Ben O'Brien, I am a New Age Christian that meditates and leads a Buddhist way of life. I have reached fourth jhana and vipassana. Can I be a bhikkhu that continues to keep my Christian values and obey the Bible? Om Mani Padme Hum. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's a little bit strange. Because, you know, there's some things, if you obey like the Christian Bible, word for word, then you've got to stone adulterers. You've got to, what are the other stuff you've got to do? People who don't keep the Sabbath, they've got to be stoned as well. So I mean, some of the stuff in the Bible is just historical stuff, which is way past its use by date. So that sort of stuff, you know, you have to let go of. So if you are, I don't care whether you're a Christian or a Buddhist, you have to use your common sense. And whether it's written in a Buddhist text or a Christian text or a Muslim text, to use your faculties and what doesn't make sense, discard it. And what makes sense, use it. Don't just approve of it and swallow it wholesale just because it was supposed to be written by the Buddha. When we just believe because the author is supposed to be infallible, that's where we get into a lot of trouble. So just use your discerning faculties. And you can be a Christian, you can be a Buddhist, I don't care which, but please be a person of that religion which I invented some years ago. The two religions to be found in this world, one which bends the truth to fit their faith, and one which bends the faith to fit the truth. Be of the second kind. No matter what your faith is, what your beliefs are, please always be ready to bend that to fit the truth, the experience of life. Be able to reject anything if it's not the truth. Doesn't matter where it comes from. There are some very dogmatic Buddhists who believe in some very strange things, and you ask them why it works. It's written in the book. I don't care if it's written in the book. Is it true or not? Does it make sense? So please remember to use your critical faculties. Don't just believe, just come and see, test it out, see if it works, see if it's truthful. So those are the two types of religions, the one which bends the faith to fit the truth. That's the one I recommend. Or the other one which bends the truth to fit their faith. Next question. Donation is a great form of accumulating merit. However, some people insist on highlighting their names when doing donations. Isn't it better to remain anonymous when doing charity? If you give a donation and you want your name acknowledged, that is not donating. That is advertising your conceit. It's advertised by advertising rights for your name. This is the Ajahn Brahm Hall, because I donated all the money. That's not donations, that's buying advertising. That's what people do in the magazines. That's, you know, the sponsor. I've often thought of this actually, to raise funds for our temples. Now, because I actually go on the internet a lot now, I'm actually quite famous. So I thought, if you want to raise money, I'd open my robe, and underneath it says, "Why, Dilmar tea, Ajahn Brahm only drinks Dilmar." Or, if Twinings gives me more sponsorship, "Twinings tea." Ajahn Brahm only flies Singapore Airlines. That'd be terrible, wouldn't it? Oh, I can tell you, this head has been shaved by Gillette. Isn't there something wrong with that? That'd be terrible if monks did that sort of stuff. I'm sure it would happen. 我吃不来。 So the idea, I've got this great idea, it's that really it's frustrating being a monk, not being able to, you know, just to forward my business ideas. But that, there's something very wrong with that, because like, giving Dharma, or just donations, if you want the name of knowledge, it's very true, that's not really a very good donation. It's just buying advertising rights for your name. So that's why the best donations are always anonymous. You give, expecting nothing back in return. And it's interesting, in Australia, that if a person gives a donation, they're in Australia, to our building fund, they can get tax exemption from that. In other words, let's say they give $1,000, and they get a receipt, then their income for tax assessment is reduced by $1,000. So if they earn, say, $50,000, then for tax purposes they've only earned $49,000, because they give $1,000 to a building fund. But only if their name is in advertising. If they put their name on their donation, it's advertised somewhere, it doesn't count, they don't get tax exemption. I thought, what a wonderful law that is. So the only way you can get tax exemption in Australia, if you give a donation, and it's basically, you get a receipt for it, it's not advertised. That's brilliant. And that's the way it should be, because the government realises, the tax people realise, it's not really a donation otherwise. It's just spreading your name. Those are the best donations. Dear Ajahn Brahm, my wife only listens to the advice of her brothers, sisters and colleagues. She doesn't listen to my advice. Of course not. You're her husband. It's against tradition for wives to listen to their husbands. And it's also against tradition for the husbands to listen to the wives. Come on, get real. And to keep saying that I am nagging, I keep repeating my advice, it's because she doesn't listen. Not that I want to nag, what should I do to get her to listen? What you should do is put what you need to say on a tape. And put it under her pillow, so when she goes to sleep at night, when she's fast asleep, don't play, it's called subliminal. She doesn't know. She's fast asleep, but the words actually go in. The psychologists use that. So when you go home, please check under your pillows. No, you can't actually say that, but one thing you can do, this is Buddhist psychology, to tell your husband or your wife what to do. It's not going to work now if she's here or you're here because they suss it out. But this is actually how it works. This is when I had another monk who was senior to me, and he was the boss. But I found out how to get my own way. There's a story when I needed to build another hut, and I told him, let's build a hut on the hill over there. He said, no, that's a stupid idea, don't be ridiculous. That's what he used to say, don't be ridiculous. I was smart. I said, okay, and I dropped it. 2 weeks later, when I knew he'd forgotten that conversation, I said again, why don't we build a hut on the hill over there? Again, he said, it's a bad idea, that's stupid, don't be ridiculous. I dropped it again. Usually only twice I needed to do this, at most three times. I've been walking with him, he said, I've just had an idea. Why don't we build a hut on the hill over there? I would never say that was my idea. I'd say, wow, what a great idea of yours. I think that might work. Yeah, let's do it. It was my idea all along. What I did was put that seed into his head. And I knew it would germinate. I just needed to reinforce it once or twice, that's all. By when he'd forgotten it, if he'd remembered it, he'd realise what I was up to and how sneaky I was. So I just made it once, twice, when he'd forgotten. And because it went into his brain, it churned over in his subconscious. I knew it was a good idea, because of course it was my idea. And he would see it. But in his subconscious, it became his idea. I didn't care whose idea it was, as long as, you know, it was going to happen. And then he did it. So if that's yours, your wife, don't nag her. Just tell her, hey, you're spending too much money on the credit card. Oh, no, I've got another. Okay, oh, fair enough, you've got a point.
Got it.
You've got the idea in her head already, okay? Don't spoil it. A couple of weeks later, she's forgot. I think we're spending too much on the credit card. Oh, no, of course we're not.
Drop it.
You just reinforced it. It's working through the system. And then a couple of weeks later, you'd be surprised how well this works. She'll say, I think I'm spending a bit too much on the credit card. But, oh, yeah, that's very kind of you, wife. It was just a lovely wife. Oh, that's all right, darling. You've got the message through. And she thinks it's her idea, which is important, otherwise she will never do it. That's actually how you do things. Very brilliant. Trouble is, people actually, they use it on me now. They say, oh, can you please come and give a talk at the Weir in July? I say, no, I can't, I'm too busy. Then I forget about it. And then you say again, oh, I'm kind of busy. How do you catch me many times? Do Ajahn Brahm. Oh, does Ajahn Brahm believe in exorcism, holy water, amulet? Thank you. Exorcisms is very rare that people are possessed. But I like getting rid of spirits. That's why I tell people, keep the 5 precepts and get rid of the spirits in your rooms, in your houses, in your bars. That's how I exercise spirits. But things which really possess people, usually it's not the case. Very, very rare. As for holy water, does holy water work? There are many types of holy water, but Ajahn Chah would never make holy water except once. And I saw him do this. He was, if you thought I was funny and rebellious, Ajahn Chah was really over the top sometimes. Because a Thai general came to see him. This is when Ajahn Chah was getting famous. What would that be, 1980 or 78 or 79? I'm not sure if it was still ruled by the military, but the military had huge power in this country in those days. So this major general came up to pay respects to Ajahn Chah. They had a lot of power. He asked for holy water. Ajahn Chah never had any, so he said, come over here, bend over. And the general bent over, and Ajahn Chah. He spat on the general's head and rubbed it in. And I thought, oh, Ajahn, you've really gone too far this time. That's a general in the army. You're going to get taken away and disappear. And that was amazing. That general loved every bit of it. Oh, sorry, sorry. That's real holy water. I can't get more holy than that. It shows you just how gullible people are. And that Ajahn Chah got away with it. He was very lucky, but you know, don't do that again. I would never dare to do that. Imagine if the MM of Singapore heard my talks and needed some holy water to have some of his in. And I said to him, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, come over here. Did I get away with that? Oh, right, some people believe in that. It's one of the favorite stories. I'll give you a toilet break after this. But this is a story I love telling because this, sometimes people think there's no sense of humor at the time of the Buddha. And this is a story in the Bhikkhuni's Code of Conduct. It's the eighth story behind the eighth Pajitya for the Bhikkhunis. I love telling this story. This was a monastery for nuns in the time of the Buddha. Early one morning, one of the young bhikkhunis was doing her duties, which was cleaning out the toilet. Now in those days they didn't have sewers and pipes, they just went into a big bucket. And she had to put it in the usual place, you know, to fertilize or whatever, to get rid of, you know, what they called the Nysol, basically all the urine and feces from the nuns the night before. But that morning she was lazy. Instead of putting it in its usual place, she threw it over the monastery wall. And of course, according to Murphy's Law, which happened even in the time of the Buddha, no Murphy's Law, if it can happen, it usually does happen. There was a man walking on the other side of the wall at that time. And he was dressed in his finest clothes because he was on the way to the palace for an appointment with the king. And as he was walking down in his finest clothes, his hair well done, this bucket of shit that had run on top of his head. Now imagine, this is from the story, this is exactly what happened. What would you do if you were going to an important business meeting and you're passing some temple in Singapore and that happened to you? Would you be abused? No way! He was so angry and upset because he knew where it came from. He knew what's on the other side of that wall. Those not Buddhist nuns. And he said, they're not real nuns, they're just prostitutes, they're whores, they're not real women, look what they've done to me. And so in those days they didn't have electric torches, they had these like fire brands which were their torches at night time. He picked up one of the fire brands. I'm going to burn down their monastery, look what they've done to me, they can't get away with this. And he went into the temple to burn it down. And a man was coming on the way out. He said, what are you doing? I'm going to burn down these nuns' temple. They're not real Buddhist nuns anyway. Look what they've done to me. And this man said, wow, you've got a bucket of nuns' shit on top of your head? That is so lucky. That is so auspicious. That's even better than holy water. That's holy shit. And that's actually what he said. And this guy, he was so gullible, he believed it. He said, well, is that really awesome? Yes, very rare that happened. He is just so lucky. Really? Look. Put away that torch, go home, get washed and changed, and I guarantee you something lucky is going to happen today. Really? Yeah. So off he went, got changed, and he was very fortunate that day he did get his contract with the king. It was a very, very good contract. And so he went around telling all his friends, you know, as they do in business, look, if you really want to do well in business. This is what happened to me. And the word got around, it got back to the Buddha. And the Buddha, come over here, nuns. And he said, you were very, very lucky that you got this smart talking man who convinced this fool that, you know, the contents of your toilet is lucky. Do not do it again. And he laid down the 8th Paticca rule for bhikkhunis. You shall not throw buckets of shit over the monastery wall. Look it up, it's there. That's the 8th rule of the Paticca section for bhikkhunis. But it just shows how gullible people are. If they did that, if that happened to me and happened to sort of, you know, throw some of my stuff over somebody and you won the lottery, then people would be coming to my toilet every week, every hour, and we'd be auctioning it before the fellowship. You've got to be a lot of them. Well, that's what I was crazy in itself. Okay. Talking about such things, maybe you should go and put some holy stuff in the toilet. Okay, we haven't had a holy toilet break. So please be back in 5 or 10 minutes.